Okay, let's go ahead and get started. So, how's it going? A lot of people are missing. We haven't seen each other in a while. This is Senior Design 1. What was your assignment due today? Block diagram and what else? I'm sorry? Right, checkpoint. How's Microsoft Project going? Useless piece of bureaucratic nonsense. Unfortunately, this is engineering, reporting to your management on your status of your schedules and all that. So hopefully you're finding that useful. What's coming up? What big events are on the horizon for this course? Design review is when? April 12th, right? So what are the major things you should be working on now, between now and April 12th?
Feedback from our reviewers.
On what?
On our preliminary design.
Okay, so most of you have received that. The mechanical engineering teams will get their feedback hopefully very shortly from Dr. Cohen. What about in terms of your overall progress on the project? You should be pretty heavy into the approach section, right? I mean, you're basically hopefully doing your designs now and working through some of those issues. How many of you met with your advisor let's see, 2 weeks ago? Well, I guess we had the PDR, so that's not a really good question, but don't be afraid to talk to your advisors about the approach section. You know, have very detailed discussions, because they should be, that's one of the sections that they should be able to help you on, or at least point you to the resources that you might need. So April 12th is going to come up pretty quickly. We're about a month away. And again, you know, try to get your slides done early enough that you can show them to your advisor before you show them at the design review. Now, the Senior Design Day is going to be hopefully you've seen this event before. Classes will be canceled. The college will be invited to attend. There'll be public presentations. The poster sessions are going to be in the library area, and the presentations are going to be in four rooms in EA, which I'll confirm later this week. But you will be preparing posters for your projects, and you'll get a little bit of instruction on that shortly. So that's going to be a big day for us. Any other issues or questions? We're missing a lot of people today. Everything's going okay. No complaints? All right, so what I wanted to talk about today are two things, cost and schedule. They sort of go together in some ways. So when I put these slides together last semester, this automobile had just been announced. It was shown at the auto show, I think, either a year ago or 6 months ago. This is a very nice Lamborghini, for those of you who are into those kinds of things. And we sort of talked about it as an example of some of the things that influence cost. One of the things that you're going to find in actual engineering projects is that there's always a trade-off. We talked early in the semester about there's always a trade-off between these four dimensions. You have performance, you have cost, you have schedule, and you have risk. And you're always trading these four off to produce a final product. So one of the things we want you to do in senior design, for those of you who are building products or building systems, we want you to do a cost analysis of what it would cost to mass produce your project. So if you're building a piece of hardware, that I think that process is relatively straightforward. If you're doing a project that's more about a design or a proposal, such as some of what the civil engineers do, the cost will be your project cost, and it won't be necessarily like building a product. But we're going to talk today about product cost, because that's something as engineers you should appreciate. So when you look at the difference between a high-end automobile like this and a low-end automobile like, whatever, your Toyota Corolla or whatever, what are the differences in terms of your overall cost goals? So does anybody have an idea how much this car costs? This is about $1 million car. I think it's $1.4 million. And it had just come out when we put the slides up. So what makes this car, and when they were designing this car, what were the design constraints? Was cost, and actually I found out, I read an article last week, that they've actually sold out of the entire production for the next year on this car, which you might think is a lot, but it turns out it's only like 12 of these or something like that. But when you're designing something like this, what kind of cost goals do you have? Keep it under $5 million. Are there any constraints? What kind of design constraints will you have on a car like this?
Weight was a big one.
Weight was a big one. And we'll talk about that in a moment. That was, in fact, the single biggest innovation on this car was the weight. Top speed. If you want to sell a car like this, it has to meet certain goals. I think this thing goes about 260 miles an hour and 0 to 60 in, half a second or some craziness like that. But the interesting thing about this is the technology. Why do companies produce cars like this at the high end? What does this have to do? How does this relate to, let's say, a Toyota Corolla? Eventually, some of the things you see in this car will find its way into Toyota Corolla. Why? And what's one of the goals in building cars like this? And if you ever go to the auto shows, you see a lot of this. You see a lot of experimental cars and things. Why do companies actually invest in building these kinds of vehicles? There's a certain amount of marketing associated with it, but what else? More practical. What else that will sort of influence your actual mass-produced type products? Exactly. This is a test bed to see how far they can push technology. Eventually, some of this technology will make its way into production automobiles. For example, the fact that your cars don't rust today because they have composite panels and things. That was at one time, composite panels were only available on these high-end cars. They experimented with that, and then eventually it trickled down. So one of the goals in this car was to see how light they could make a high-end, very fast sports car like this. And in fact, what's novel about this car, and what really kind of blew the designers away, is it only weighs 2,200 pounds. And they achieved that weight by using this carbon fiber reinforced plastics, which is going to eventually be, you're going to see in a lot of cars, especially electric vehicles. And you'll see that also in a lot of other vehicles like airplanes and things like that. So this is an example of a car where cost, low cost is not going to be your primary goal. The primary goal on this car is to push technology and to appeal to really high-end buyers. Now, let's talk at the other end of the scale now. Let's talk a little bit about an iPad. In fact, the iPad 2s just came out the other day, and quite surprisingly, they were not that expensive. I mean, I think they're selling them for the same price as they sold the iPad 1. So when you design something like an iPad, what's going to be your cost goals? What was innovative about the iPad?
Affordable.
Affordable. So what does affordable mean in today's market? I mean, what did the iPad, what was the retail price of the iPad?
It was like $600, $500.
It was $499.
Yes.
And why did they choose that price?
It was under $500.
Because they wanted it to, well, and what were some of the constraints? If they had done the iPad about 10 years ago, they would have marketed it at the high end.
Based on like, want to be like a laptop or like that
price. Well, what were some of the things they were competing against? Netbooks? What else?
Kindles.
Kindles were sell for about what?
179
or in that range. Netbooks sell for 300. High-end laptops sell for 1,000, 2,000. Decent laptops sell for about $650. You could buy laptops for $300, so the iPad's actually more expensive than cheap at low-end laptops, which is a market they're competing against. And what was the design challenge with selling an iPad for $499? Retail costs $499. So what do you think the cost in parts was of the iPad? I hope nobody's read ahead on the slides.
Isn't it like $400?
If the cost was $400, would Apple be selling iPads? Why? We're talking about the cost in parts. And I'll show you in a moment a spreadsheet where we add up all the parts. Yeah, you're getting to, that's going to be my point, the profit margin issue. What do you think, typically, if it sells for $500, what do you think the cost in parts should be if you want to have a nice profitable business? I'm going to give you my magic rule of thumb on cost, which seems to have worked for me for like the last 30 years. You typically, a rule of thumb I learned when I worked at Texas Instruments many years ago, and it's amazing to me how this is held up in some markets, most markets. You take the cost of parts and multiply by 4. So $500 iPad, we're talking $125 in parts. You think you can build an iPad for $125 in parts? So you're going to have to get some pretty cheap components. Well, it turns out the iPad does not meet that goal. Some electronics products like laptops and iPads and cell phones do not meet those goals because the markets are so competitive. But certainly when they were looking at, when Apple was looking at producing the iPad, cost was a big issue, and they knew they were not going to have a healthy profit margin on this. I mean, it was really tight, and there was a lot of industry speculation about what features were going to be included. For example, they didn't put the wireless in as a built-in because they wanted to save a little bit of money, so they priced it as an add-on because they felt they had to hit the market. So I have here a spreadsheet. This comes from one of these sites that specializes in iSupply. That it's a really cool site because they disassemble products and figure out what they cost. This is the cost of the baseline iPad. The total in parts was $229. That's estimate, but that's proven to be pretty close. And this was iPad 1. iPad 2 actually retails for about the same, and it's got, you know, more faster and better and all that. But at the time this was done, we had about a markup of about a factor of 2. Which is a bit thin. I mean, Apple's not going to make a lot of money on this product. Though electronics products tend to these days, you don't see factors of 4 because the market just doesn't bear. Yeah.
Is the thing to consider with products like this, even like an Xbox, is that the software for it you can't get for free like a normal computer.
I was just going to talk about that. Excellent, excellent. So let's talk about cell phones. Why is it you get cell phones for free? Because they make all the money on the service, right? So exactly, excellent point. The same thing with the readers and the Kindles and all that, is that they realize they're going to make money more on the services and the software than on the actual hardware. So there's a subsidy going on there. Now, how did they get the cost down to this? So you mass production. So what happens is they have to shop around the world and find places where they can buy components really cheaply in large quantities. So when you look at the distribution of this thing, what do you think is the single largest component of the cost? Well, it's the display. And those kinds of displays are manufactured probably in three factories around the world. There are very few companies that produce these, and everyone else resells or buys them. So a company like Apple, of course, can go in and negotiate a really good rate for some of these core components. But when you talk about $80 price, and this is I think the key point for the cost component of my lecture today, if you look that touchscreen, that particular touchscreen up on the web on DigiKey in quantity one, is it going to cost you $80? No, it's going to cost you maybe $800 or $8,000. Because they don't want to sell you one of these. The way you get this price down to $80 is you sign a contract that you're going to purchase 1 million of these things. One of the things, if you get involved in the consumer electronics business, you're going to find out is that your company that sells consumer electronics actually acts as a bank. One of my more interesting stories about this when I was at Texas Instruments was we were making a consumer toy for Christmas, a toy called the Julie doll, which had speech recognition in it, which is what I do research on. And the toy companies basically have no money other than after Christmas. So we actually, the toy company agreed to buy a very large quantity of DSPs from us with our software, but we had to lend them the money to buy that, and then they were going to pay us back after the toy sold for Christmas. So you not only do you get these prices down, but very often you have to, as the manufacturer, you have to lend the company that wants to buy these things money so that they can make the product, they can then sell the product and use that revenue to actually pay for what they bought from you. So there's a lot of kind of financial stuff that goes on behind the scenes in building products like this. Now, for Apple's pretty wealthy, so they probably wouldn't fall in that class, but a lot of the small technology-driven toy companies and things actually do have those kinds of issues where you have to loan them money. So you get this price down through volume. So when you price out your senior design projects, I want you to estimate the quantity of the thing you're going to sell. Some of you may be doing things that could potentially sell 1 million units a year. Some of you may be doing things that will only sell 1,000 units a year. But whatever it is, you figure out what that quantity is, and this relates to your problem statement where you talk a little bit about the market that you're trying to hit, and then you look up prices for these components in those quantities. And then you cost out your system, the cost of parts, in those quantities, and you'll find then that the components do tend to drop significantly in price because a lot of components can be very inexpensive when you buy them in volume, such as touch screens and things, but buying one or two of them, they're very expensive. And that's actually something you'll face in your projects as you're trying to fit into your $500 budget or whatever it is you're working from, that sometimes getting one of these is difficult. Sometimes you can buy a sample, you can get a sample for free from a company. But buying one of things is very expensive. So I don't know why students struggle with this every semester, but I want to make sure this is clear, that when we ask you for the cost of your product or your system, it has to be priced in the quantities that you're going to sell that system in. Now, when you price out all the parts, you come up with a number, But then, of course, the retail price is going to be much greater than that. We talk about a factor of four. So what are some of the things that contribute to the cost? Why is there that factor of four?
The resource that went into it.
You have to recover your costs, what we call the non-recurring engineering costs, the NRE, certainly. There's going to be your whole marketing thing. The amount of money you devote to marketing actually varies from product to product. What's one of the most extreme cases of where marketing costs are a very, very large percentage of your overall product? Pharmaceuticals is good. I haven't had that answer before. We'll come back to that. That's a good. There's a different type of thing that goes into the cost of pharmaceuticals. Movies? No? No? Food profit margins actually are pretty lean.
Cars?
No? One of my favorites to talk about, especially since we have ladies in the classroom, is cosmetics. 80 to 90% of the cost of cosmetics is marketing. It's a very marketing-driven market. There's actually a fair amount of technology today behind it as well, but in a market like that, 80 to 90% of your cost is going to be marketing. Now, what about a market like semiconductor manufacturing? There's markets at the other end of that scale. So I worked for a company, Texas Instruments, that's the last remaining American semiconductor manufacturer, and their profit margins are about 8%. So they'll do $15 billion in sales, and they'll be lucky to make 8%, 4%. Now, why is that a bad deal? In a normal economy, let me say, why is that a bad deal? If you're in a business like that, why is that a problem? No. Why is your profit margin a big issue when you're trying to run a company? What about shareholders? Well, a lot of stocks don't pay dividends. No. 8% profit, you know, 8% profit is 8%, right? If you sell a dollar, sell $100, it's still 8%. What are you competing against at the when you try to create a company and finance that business? In what sense? So where are you going to get these loans from? A bank, let's say? Investors, thank you. So you come to me, I'm rich, and you say, I want to start a company. And I want you to give me $100, and I will give you back $8 profit on that in a year. What am I going to think as an investor? Why? Thank you. It used to be you could put your money in the bank, you could put your money in mutual funds, you could invest your money any number of ways, and you could make more money at much less risk than investing in your crazy idea. So if you get further into this, if some of you take the entrepreneurship class, or if some of you go into doing business plans and things, you'll face these kinds of issues. Is this business a sound business to be in? And today with the internet, there's a lot of extreme cases of this. You take companies like eBay, you know, people say, oh, eBay's so expensive, so successful. It took eBay a long time before they ever broke a profit. One of my colleagues works at a company in my field. They've been in business now 13 years and they've never made a profit. They're on their third round of venture capital. And I have no idea why people continue to invest in this company, but they do. So, why we worry about profit margin is because that's going to determine essentially how viable your company is, and that's going to reflect in your stock price and your shareholders and all that kind of stuff. Now, the times four multiplier, there's a lot of things that go into that, as we talked about, including things like health insurance for your employees, profit sharing for your employees, stock options for your employees, including things like environmental regulations and such. And when you start thinking about these issues, this is why you start to think about manufacturing outside the U.S., where you can avoid some of these costs by going to so-called third world countries. We had a seminar speaker yesterday who was talking about nuclear plants, and he was talking about the fact that the difference in cost between building a nuclear plant on this side of the Mexican border versus the Mexican side of the Mexican-American border, just moving that plant 1 mile across that border, it results in a tremendously different, a large amount of cost savings for that nuclear plant, because once you go into Mexico, there's none of the regulations that we have here in the U.S. So when you start looking at your products, when you look at your senior design projects and you total up the parts costs, it gets really interesting, because you start to find out it's pretty hard to meet your cost goals if you have this times four multiplier. The cost in parts starts to get really small, and that's where the engineering comes in. The engineering comes in trying to optimize this system. Every penny of this design has been optimized to meet these cost goals. Getting the cost down to $499 on this product did not happen overnight. Apple spent about a year iterating on cost to get it right. And the decisions to drop wireless and some of those things were influenced by the fact that they had to hit this target. So cost is a very important piece of your design constraints, and that's why a number of your projects have cost constraints. So every senior design project must address cost and schedule. Cost is quoted as manufacturing costs, not development costs. So any questions on that? I hope that's pretty straightforward. So let me now talk about the other side of this, which is schedule. And this is actually a presentation that I got from, it's a presentation given to the government. They have a series of these training courses. If you ever get to be a government program manager, you'll go have the opportunity to go through a lot of these presentations. But I wanted to talk a little bit about scheduling. So, what's the purpose of building these schedules in Microsoft Project? This is something all engineering projects you deal with in the real world, you'll have to deal with schedule. What are some of the obvious reasons that you need to worry about schedule? And why isn't it good enough just to say, well, we'll be done when we're done?
Your investors want to know when you'll be able to make money off of it so they can plan around that.
So from a design engineering point of view, why are you going to have to commit to schedules?
Because people paying for it won't know.
What's going to happen after you've designed your system? There's many phases to the engineering cycle, right, including testing. What about manufacturing? Do you just hand your design over to manufacturing organization and suddenly they turn the crank and the production line's running? In some industries which are rather extreme, like the automotive industry, how long will, in the old days at least, it would take them years just to build the manufacturing line for the car you were trying to design. Today they've gotten a little bit better at that, but gearing up for large-scale manufacturing takes time, and therefore they've got schedules that drive that. because they'll typically wind down manufacturing on one product and ramp up manufacturing on another product. So as a design engineer, one of the reasons you have schedules is because you're going to find out pretty quickly you're dependent on all these other organizations for schedule. Anytime you want to put a product into production or delivery, the manufacturing, you'll have these kinds of deadlines. And these deadlines, there's a lot of things that influence these deadlines. So once, you know, you get into working in real projects, you're going to learn about all sorts of wonderful things like fiscal year boundaries. Why are fiscal year boundaries so important to you? What happens every quarter? If you work for a company that's publicly traded, this is another scheduling constraint you probably haven't thought much about. What happens every quarter at a major company? They read their financial report. And why does the CEO lose sleep over those financial reports? Because the stock price is going to fluctuate. By the time that report comes out, the stock market analyst will actually have projected what your report is going to be. And they'll be watching very closely whether you meet those targets. So what a lot of companies do, which was eye-opening to me, is they will actually book sales for a quarter. We used to, when I was at Texas Instruments, we used to get tons of equipment midway through the next quarter. But most of that equipment was actually purchased at the end of the previous quarter because those companies wanted to put those sales on the books for that quarter. So there was it was always funny because at the end of every quarter, a massive amount of purchase orders would go out. And you'll have the same kind of thing with fiscal year boundaries. So another reason you do schedules is because the money financing your project, it's not a continuous stream. There's certain times that money's available and there's certain times that money isn't available, and you have to synchronize to that. So there are a lot of those kinds of administrative bureaucratic issues, but what from an engineering point of view, and I hope you've already experienced a little bit of this, why is the scheduling process so useful and important to you? Let's talk pre-development.
It helps you break down your project.
It helps you break down the project, and that's the main thing I wanted to drive across today in this module was learning how to decompose your projects so that they can be worked in parallel is really important in any engineering activity. Understanding the dependencies between the different pieces of your project is really important, and therefore the exercise of creating this schedule, I hope, has been useful to you in terms of decomposing your project, assigning people to various tasks, and then synchronizing all of that. So scheduling is forming a network of activities and event relationships that portray the sequential relations between the tasks in a project. We talked about the fact that you cannot do projects sequentially. That just takes too much time. You always have to do projects in parallel. Plan completion of a project based on logical arrangement of activities and resources. Another thing you're going to encounter in industry on almost any project is that some of the key resources you need are only available at certain times. If you've ever watched a large construction project, large construction projects are massive logistics problems because you have to make sure the various subcontractors are available at certain times to do certain pieces of work, and you have to organize all that. And it's the same thing with engineering projects, that you will have key resources. Perhaps it's a mechanical engineer who designs your packaging, or it's an electronics engineer who designs your circuits, and these people will be available only at certain times in the project, and you have to make sure that these people. You synchronize all this because nobody, typically as engineers, you'll not work 100% on one project. You'll probably have two or three projects that you're charging about some percentage of your time to. So you also learn as an engineer to split your time across different projects. So while scheduling is all these things, the main thing to remember is that scheduling is the development of planned dates for performing project activities and meeting milestones. So you have some milestones in this course. We have things like the midterm reviews, the final reviews, end of semester, and all of your schedules have to line up to meet those deadlines. And hopefully you've actually spent some time trying to configure the project to meet those deadlines. But I know in reality, at this stage, a lot of you just kind of make all this stuff up so it all looks nice. But really, when you get a little bit more experience with this, you're going to spend time actually working on the schedule to make sure everything lines up properly. So this is a slide which sort of overviews some philosophy about planning. Generally speaking, you're going to be worried about the tasks. You're going to be worried about the resources it takes to do those tasks, and you're going to be worried about the overall time that it takes to do those tasks. And those three things sort of combine to form your schedule. Here's a little bit more about issues like where it will be performed, who will perform the work, and what sequence. Tools like Microsoft Project are designed to really help you with the sequencing of things. So scheduling determines the timing of operations in the project. The schedule will determine the specific start and completion dates and all project activities. Scheduling, a related piece of scheduling is actually cost. Now, you could actually calculate the cost of your projects by simply taking the number of hours of labor times, for example, a nominal labor cost. And that was, and you can, so you can actually take your Microsoft Project schedules and compute your labor costs from them. And that's typically what you'll do in a real project, because for any project, you'll have a certain amount of funding allocated to labor. One of the key things is the work breakdown structure, which we'll talk about in a moment, and then the other piece of that is the relationships between various activities. So the process that one will typically go through in terms of project scheduling is to develop a list of project activities. That's something we talked about at the beginning of the semester. Hopefully most of you have done that by now. Sequence those activities. Figure out which are dependent on which. Determine the relationships between the activities. Establish the duration for the activities. And then from that, determine the overall project duration, which is something project will help you actually compute. Developing a list of project activities is as simple as it sounds. Now, I know in senior design, students often say, well, how can I know all this stuff when I haven't built this thing before? After I've built it, I can kind of tell you what everything's involved. But you're going to find in most engineering projects you encounter, you're always doing something for the first time, and therefore you're going to have to learn how to predict what's involved, because that's actually a very large part of engineering, is predicting the cost of a project before you ever do it. This is actually, you'll come to realize over time, this is one of your most valuable skills as an engineer, is your ability to predict and manage projects, predict costs and manage projects and that kind of thing. So here's an example of decomposing a book into various pieces. Well, a book is pretty straightforward because books are sort of naturally segregated into sections and chapters and subsections and such. So this would be a very logical decomposition of the process of writing a book, and because you've got it broken down in terms of chapters and sections and such. Not all engineering projects are as easy as this. This is what's known. This decomposition of tasks is what's known as a work breakdown structure. You'll hear that term used pretty frequently these days. So here's a list of activities associated with the with this book, and that'll actually that looks a little bit like what you'll see in Microsoft Project. And and there's already some attempt to reflect the hierarchy that you saw previously in terms of tasks. Now, one thing, this is a pretty, actually, in the process of writing a book, this is pretty simplistic, because you'll notice there's no time built in for actually iterating on the book after it's been reviewed and such, which, in terms of writing an actual book, is a significant piece of it. So in this course, you go through multiple design reviews, and you're going to reflect feedback from those design reviews in your subsequent designs and such. So once you have a list of basic tasks, then the next question is, how do you sequence these tasks? How do you determine which of the tasks needs to get done first? And I think that, you know, with a good understanding of your project, that's not such a difficult thing to do. So we start with the work breakdown structure. We generate the task list. Then we start sequencing the tasks. So you might also think of this as a flow chart. Now, one of the things we often get hung up in this class is when we ask for a block diagram, students often think we want a what you might call a flow chart for the project. But what we really want for the block diagram is more of a technical description of the actual technology or the project you're doing. But this is certainly a flow chart for how you're going to execute the project. So it's essentially a project management flow chart. Now, what doesn't this reflect? What are some of the missing pieces at this point? Many of you might say, oh, that's great. Once we have that, we're done. It doesn't reflect time. In what sense? Why is this not a sufficient tool for managing the project? When you look at a structure like this, what's the potential pitfall? You could, in senior design, for example, you could arrive at this and find out that there's no way you could complete your project in 2 semesters. Why? What are some of the additional pieces of information you need to know here? So we have these two parallel paths, right? And they're supposed to converge at this point in both space and time, right? What happens if this path takes 1 week and this path takes 3 years? That's a big problem, right? You could potentially have a group of people waiting here while the people assigned to this path are working away. So even though this is good from a conceptual point of view, this is far from what you need in terms of a schedule, because it doesn't really have any kind of time synchronization of these events. It could be that some of these paths take a lot longer than others, and that's going to create bottlenecks. If these people are finished early, they're going to have to go off and either work on some other project, or you're going to think about other ways we can use these people over here to speed up these tasks. So this is just a little bit about this, about the process of sequencing. I don't really want to go spend too much on that. But the next step that you need to start to think about is how these things are going to relate to one another in terms of time. Because it's possible that, for example, you can take resources working here, and once they're finished, you can apply them over here. So you can move resources around, and this is really why you use tools like Microsoft Project. Now, so once you have that sequencing and you know roughly which things can be done independently of others, now the hardest part is the process of assigning the duration to each task. And this is hard, and you're certainly not going to be able to do this very well in senior design because you don't have a lot of experience with this. But what are some of the things you should think about when you're actually putting in the amount of time it takes to do tasks? So if you define a task, let's say, for example, writing the project control section for Chapter 2. How are you going to go about estimating the amount of time that task is going to take? What are some of the ways you think, or tools you might use to estimate how that task is going to be done? How do you do this when you have a writing assignment? So I gave the intro to engineering students a writing assignment. It was what, four pages or something like that? 5,000 words, or so. How do you do time management on this? When I tell you the problem statement is 2 pages, and please don't tell me the answer is you don't ever think about how long this is going to take. Seriously, how do you? I'm hoping by now the seniors, you actually think about how long each one of your homework assignments and things are going to take, and you kind of allocate your time accordingly.
You like break it up into like if you got to do research, and then how long writing is going to take, and then editing by writing.
That would be one way to do it, but that's a lot of work. So let me ask this question another way. How many lines of code do you think a productive programmer produces each day of work? People have studied this, and there's a whole field of software engineering that studies this, and they actually have metrics. They can show you, you can take a piece of code, you can run it through a program, and it will approximate the amount of time it takes to write that code. It looks at various complexity factors, what are called function points and things. If you're a highly productive programmer, and you average the amount of code you generate over the course of a year, how many lines of code do you think you produce per day, per work day? 100. We have 100. 10?
Yes. You got to think of like all the stuff that goes into it before you.
What is some of the stuff that goes into it?
Math.
Meetings. Design reviews.
Stuff that's
vacations. Debugging. Rewriting. If you produce 5 lines of code per day, you're a productive programmer. Now, that's pretty depressing, right, to think you spent 8 hours. But if you actually look at statistics on this, they're on that in that order, depending somewhat on the code. Similarly with writing. I mean, by now, each of you should have some idea of how much time it takes for you to write a page or to write so many words. And when I say, well, I need a two-page problem statement, you should be able to estimate how many hours that takes you to produce.
How many times do you rewrite this 5 months?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, that's all that goes into it. We used to have a saying that, you know, every good program I've written has been written 3 or 4 times over before I got it right. So, but that's all factored into this, because that's what makes your projects take a lot of time. You never get it. You look back and you say, oh, I could have written those 5 lines of code in 2 minutes, but it took you 3 days to figure out what those code. So one of the ways you would estimate this project is you would have some guidelines on how many pages or how many words of text somebody can produce a day for this type of activity. And there's a lot you'll find in every one of your disciplines, there's a lot of metrics now about this kind of stuff. And that's part of the project management process, is to predict, based on some of these metrics, roughly how much effort each one of these tasks are going to take. And this is actually a pretty easy one to do, because most of these writing tasks, you can sort of figure out how long it's going to take someone to produce that amount of text. For example, in this project, I would say a very productive writer would probably have trouble producing a chapter in less than a week. It's going to take you at least a week to write. If you talk about a textbook, like a good quality textbook, it's going to take you at least a week to write that chapter. If you're talking about a 400-page textbook, you're probably talking about a year's worth of writing. So, you know, that's the answer here is that you'll have a lot of metrics, you'll have a lot of project experience, you'll draw on other people's project experience to estimate these things. But there's also things you have to take into account, which are things like vacation schedules and things like, so how many of your schedules, for example, took into account what was going to happen over spring break? And vacation schedules, especially when critical people take vacations, that's a real challenge on a project, because when someone takes vacation, you just can't let the project kind of grind to a halt. So you actually, in real project scheduling, you will schedule in when people are going to take vacations on your project, because that is going to influence things. So this presentation goes through some rules of thumb about how to estimate labor. I don't think that's as relevant to senior design, but when you get down into industry, like I said, you'll have some resources to estimate this. In fact, most of you in industry, if you have to do scheduling, there'll be a designated person at your company who's sort of the master scheduler, who keeps track of all this. Why is this important? Well, because at some point you're going to commit to a budget, especially if you're proposing this project to an outside organization, like you're proposing to build a highway for a government agency, or you're proposing to build a piece of equipment for military. At some point, you're going to commit to an overall cost of that project, and out of that cost, your labor is going to have to be covered. And so you are going to have to get this fairly close, because it's going to influence your profit margin on the project. So when you get to this point, now you're beginning to get a pretty good handle on this, because you now have the amount of effort for each task, you have the subtasks, and you have a sequencing. Now, what's the last thing that's missing here?
Putting them in parallel, or like what's going to be done at this time.
Not quite. That's the sort of the sequencing. We need one more important piece of information here. Amber?
Who's in charge of it?
Not who's in charge. Close. Who's going to do these things, right? Why is that an issue? particularly on your senior design teams, why is that an issue? Well, when I watch projects initially set up, it's always fun to see, well, this is going to be Mary, 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 this is going to be Mary. And the rest of the team will do the other tasks. What's wrong with that? And you see this on a lot of projects. What's wrong with that? In what sense? Why?
She doesn't have enough time.
Mary doesn't have enough time. You start adding up all those times, and you say, well, Mary's going to be working 200% on the project, and the rest of the team is going to be slacking. So you say, well, we'll offload these things to some of the other members on the project. Why is that a problem?
They might be tied to other projects.
There's that issue. What about skill sets? Mary may be the only one on your senior design team who can do this integrated circuit design or this circuit board layout. So you also have to put people, you have to put names to these tasks, because that's going to be another issue is, can you arrange all these tasks across the people that you have to work with? Do the skill sets match? Are the people available when you need them to do those tasks? Now, Mary may say, well, I have to go away for spring break. I can't do that task over spring break. John may say, I have an exam this week. I can't do anything on senior design. So one of the reasons I encourage you to schedule down to this level of detail is because you have nominally about 40 hours per week across a four-person team for senior design, if that. And you have to make sure that all these tasks fit within those 40 hours a week. And anytime something slips, if you schedule your project, what we call maximum loading, anytime something slips, those are no longer hours you can make up because everybody's fully loaded. So you have to put people to the tasks and you have to sort of arrange this so that everybody has an equal load. Now, in a highly functioning team, how do they achieve that? And that was the last point I wanted to make today. When you look at highly functioning teams, what's one of the characteristics of a highly functioning team? How do sports teams survive when one of their key athletes gets injured? Do you have bench players in senior design?
No, but you can need somebody else to step up.
So what's that called? What's one of these nice industry buzzwords for that?
Compensation.
No, not compensation. Cross-training. What does the principle of cross-training mean? Make sure, this is one of the reasons I force everybody to present. You have to make sure that everybody on the team can do at least one or two other functions. Because somebody's going to get sick, somebody's going to have a family emergency, or any of these kinds of things, you need somebody else to be able to step up and do that task. When you have a project where there's only one person for every critical function, that's a project that's probably going to fail. In highly functioning teams, people switch off, they pick up the slack. That all kind of happens nicely because people have skills that apply to multiple aspects of the project. Particularly in second semester, you'll find this, especially as we get to this part of the semester. Between now and the senior design day in second semester, you'll have a lot of exams hit. And you'll be frantically trying to get your hardware finished, and everyone will be stressed out because they have exams to deal with. And that's when it becomes important that people can sort of trade off duties and things like that. So in industry, this is known as cross-training, and many of you will be cross-trained in your workplace on different functions. It's something you should always volunteer for because it helps you be more valuable to your company, the fact that you can do multiple jobs. Okay, so any questions on this? Now, this is all pretty high level, and I realize to actually apply this to your project is going to take a little bit of work. But again, talk with your advisors. This is one area where your advisors can be very helpful, is how to decompose your problem into pieces that can be worked in parallel. Okay? Any questions? All right. So I will see you next week. There's actually one of the areas, let me just say one quick thing, now I forgot to mention this. Many of you will begin to learn about certifications. If you think you're done with school when you graduate with your bachelor's degree, nope, your company's going to send you to various trainings to get what are called certifications. One of the areas of growth is this project management certification. And you'll meet people at your companies who actually have certificates in things like project management. They're, and your company will often want to send you to get this kind of training. So as your career develops, you're going to find yourself picking up these kinds of certificates. It's been one of the hot things the last few years to get these specialties. And sometimes they'll actually send you away to school for a semester to pick up these kinds of specialties. In project management, there's actually formal courses you take and exams you have to pass. It's like being a certified family financial planner. You can be a certified project manager and get actual official certifications in this. And some of you will go on to do that. Okay. So, what are we building?